So the real question would be, he said finally, if people were given the choice between democracy and whiteness, how many would choose whiteness? We let that settle in the air, neither of us willing to hazard a guess to that one. Chapter 29, The Price We Pay for a Caste System. Leon Lederman was an American physicist who won a Nobel Prize in 1988 for his groundbreaking contributions to our understanding of the particles of nature. Decades afterward, when he was in his early 90s, he began to suffer memory loss and to require additional care. In 2015, he took the extraordinary step of auctioning off his Nobel Prize medal for $765,000 to cover medical bills that were mounting. In 2018, he died in a nursing home, his Nobel Prize in the hands of someone else. Compared to our counterparts in the developed world, America can be a harsh landscape, a less benevolent society than other wealthy nations. It is the price we pay for our caste system. In places with a different history and hierarchy, it is not necessarily seen as taking away from one's own prosperity if the system looks out for the needs of everyone. People show a greater sense of joint responsibility to one another when they see their fellow citizens as like themselves, as in the nations of Western Europe or in Australia, a diverse country with a looser hierarchy. Societies can be more magnanimous when people perceive themselves as having an equal stake in the lives of their fellow citizens. There are thriving, prosperous nations where people do not have to sell their Nobel Prizes to get medical care, where families don't go broke taking care of elderly loved ones, where children exceed the educational achievements of American children, where drug addicts are in treatment rather than prison, where perhaps the greatest measure of human success, happiness, and a long life exists in greater measure, because they value their shared commonality. In a video that went viral at the end of 2019, British citizens are shown being asked to guess what they think routine medical procedures covered by their own healthcare system would cost in the United States. Time and again, the interviewees woefully underestimate the cost to Americans, some bellowing, gobsmacked at the actual prices, some refusing to believe that anyone would have to pay that much for basic, necessary care. $10,000? One woman asks when told the average cost of childbirth. For a baby? Mad. One man is asked how much he thinks it costs for an ambulance to take you to the hospital. There's a price for that? He asks. Why? I'm genuinely speechless, one woman says. The majority of America's peer nations have some form of free or low-cost healthcare coverage. The writer Jonathan Chait noted America's singular indifference, unique among developed nations, toward helping all of its citizens. He connected this hard-heartedness to the hierarchy that arose from slavery. He found that even conservatives in other wealthy nations are more compassionate than many Americans. Few industrialized economies provide as stingy aid to the poor as the United States, he observed in New York Magazine in 2014. In none of them is the principle of universal health insurance even contested by a major conservative party. Conservatives have long celebrated America's unique strand of anti-statism as the product of our religiosity, or the tradition of English liberty, or the searing experience of the tea tax. But the factor that stands above all the rest is slavery. A caste system builds rivalry and distrust and lack of empathy toward one's fellows. The result is that the United States, for all its wealth and innovation, lags in major indicators of quality of life among the leading countries in the world. There are more public mass shootings in America than in any other country, and the United States has one of the highest rates of gun deaths in the developed world, according to the World Health Organization. Americans own more guns per capita than any other nation. Americans own nearly half of the guns in the world owned by civilians. The United States has the highest incarceration rate in the world, higher than that of Russia and China, with a rate of 655 per 100,000. The United States imprisons more people, 2.2 million, than any other nation. The incarceration rate in America is so high that the line representing the United States extends well off the page in graphics of the prison rates in the developed world. If the U.S. prison population were a city, it would be the fifth largest in America. American women are more likely to die during pregnancy and childbirth than women in other wealthy nations, with 14 deaths per 100,000 live births. The maternal mortality rate in America is nearly three times the rate in Sweden, according to the Commonwealth Fund. Part of this reflects the woeful maternal death rates for Black and Indigenous women in the United States. Life expectancy in the United States is the lowest among the 11 highest income countries: United Kingdom, Canada, Germany, Australia, Japan, Sweden, France, the Netherlands, Switzerland, and Denmark. The life expectancy in America is 78.6 years, as against a combined average of 82.3 years and against 84.2 for Japan, the country with the longest life expectancy based on a 2019 analysis. Infant mortality in the United States is highest among the richest nations, 5.8 deaths per 1,000 live births, as against a combined average of 3.6 per 1,000 live births for the richest countries, as against about 2 per 1,000 in Japan and Finland. American students score near the bottom in industrialized nations in mathematics and reading. 15-year-olds in the United States scored well below students in peer nations on math literacy, below Latvia and the Slovak Republic, among the dozens of countries that exceed U.S. test scores. By the time that the first woman major party candidate ran for president in 2016, some 60 other countries had already had a woman head of state, including India, Germany, Australia, and the United Kingdom, and smaller countries such as Iceland, Norway, Burundi, and Slovenia. And in perhaps the most important measure of all for citizens anywhere, the United States ranked 18th in happiness in the world, just above the Czech Republic, according to the consortium of organizations, including Gallup, that publishes the results each year. The United States has fallen seven spots since 2012, a testimony to our continuing discontents. In the winter of 2020, the one year in human history that would hold the promise of perfect insight, an invisible life form awakened in the Eastern Hemisphere and began to spread across the oceans. The Earth's most powerful nation watched as faraway workers in hazmat gear tested for what no one could see, and deluded itself into believing that American exceptionalism would somehow grant it immunity from the sorrows of other countries. Yet the virus arrived on these shores, and it planted itself in the gaps of disparity, the torn kinships and fraying infrastructure in the country's caste system, just as it exploited the weakened immune system in the human body. Soon, America had the largest coronavirus outbreak in the world. Governors pleaded for basic supplies, and test kits were reduced to bidding against one another for ventilators. As usual, read a headline in The Atlantic, "Americans must go it alone." The virus exposed both the vulnerability of all humans and the layers of hierarchy. While anyone could contract the virus, it was Asian Americans who were scapegoated for it merely because they looked like the people from the part of the world that the virus first struck. And as the crisis wore on, it was African Americans and Latino Americans who began dying at higher rates. Pre-existing conditions, often tied to the stresses on marginalized people, contributed to the divergence. But it was the caste-like occupations at the bottom of the hierarchy, grocery clerks, bus drivers, package deliverers, sanitation workers, low-paying jobs with high levels of public contact, that put them at greater risk of contracting the virus in the first place. These are among the mudsill jobs in a pandemic, the jobs less likely to guarantee health coverage or sick days, but that sustain the rest of society, allowing others to shelter in place. As the number of deaths climbed to the highest in the world, America, and those looking to it for leadership, had to come to terms with the untested fragilities of its social ecosystem. "To a watching world," wrote The Guardian, "the absence of a fair, affordable U.S. healthcare system, the cutthroat contest between American states for scarce medical supplies, the disproportionate death toll among ethnic minorities, chaotic social distancing rules, and a lack of centralized coordination are reminiscent of a poor developing country, not the most powerful, influential nation on earth." The pandemic and the country's fitful, often self-centered lack of readiness exposed a failure of character unparalleled in U.S. history, in the words of Stephen Walt, a professor of international relations at Harvard University. The pandemic forced the nation to open its eyes to what it might not have wanted to see, but needed to see, while forcing humanity to contemplate its impotence against the laws of nature. "This is a civilization searching for its humanity," Gary Michael Tartikoff, an American scholar of caste, said of this country. "It dehumanized others to build its civilization. Now it needs to find its own." Part 7. Awakening. Chapter 30. Shedding the Sacred Thread. Near the sacred waters of the alluvial plains east of the Thar Desert, a man born to the highest caste in India had awakened slowly to a privileged despair. He had a position of rank in civil society and a highborn wife and family. He was a Brahmin of the priestly caste, above even kings and warriors. He was the Indian equivalent of the bluest of blood in America. Unlike ordinary men, he was twice born, first of his mother's womb and then of the temple during the rite of passage for boys of the upper castes. The Brahmin, the Kshatriya, and the Vaishya alone have historically been granted this singular elevation. It is one of the many things, perhaps the most prized transcendent thing, that set upper caste men apart from lower ones as the most favored by the gods. Many years before, on the day that he, as a young Brahmin boy, went through his second birth, his head had been shaved and he was bathed in a ritual cleansing. The Brahmin priest read from holy text and called upon the god Vishnu for his strength and protection. At the appointed hour, they slipped a sacred thread around his neck that fell over his bare shoulders and draped it across his chest, three interwoven threads representing the body, the mind, and the tongue with which to speak wisdom. This was his initiation into Brahmin manhood, and henceforth, he was to wear the sacred thread at all times, under his clothing by day, to sleep in it by night, and to wash in it, as it remained one with his skin. He was to keep it clean and pure, as a Brahmin was to remain clean and pure, and to replace it if it became frayed or polluted, if, for example, he were by chance touched by any one of the lower castes. When he became old enough to shave, he would have to tuck it behind his ear or hold it under his chin as he washed to protect it. The sacred thread was an extension of his Brahmin body, the purest of all human bodies, and a signal to everyone of his high rank in the land. He was now permitted to take meals with the men in the family and village and learn his place among the men of high caste. But on a Sunday thereafter, his father was out surveying his land. The father came across a farm worker on his land, but the farm worker did not bid the father the respect due a Brahmin lord in the father's eyes. The laborer was a Dalit, the lowest of the castes, one whose very shadow was polluting to the boy and his father's caste. The Dalits were trained to bend in fear at the sight of their superiors. Untold thousands of Dalits had lost their lives for offending the upper castes and were at their mercy. The boy's father took a stick and charged after the Dalit laborer. The Dalit pulled the limb of a tree to protect himself from the father. Seeing this, the father gathered his senses and retreated from the Dalit and ran away from him. But a group of fellow Brahmins witnessed the father running, saw him permit an untouchable to chase away his master. The father had not upheld his superiority over the Dalit. He had brought dishonor to his caste by allowing an inferior to prevail over him. The caste system had a way of policing the behavior of everyone in its wake to keep everyone in their assigned places. Now he had brought shame and humiliation to himself, to his line, and to his caste in that one moment. Seeing no option to retain his honor, the father fled the village. His family searched and searched for him, and finally found him chanting in a room surrounded by images of the gods. "I lost my father that day," the Brahmin recalled many decades later, "and I lost my childhood." Perhaps his father had been mentally unwell from the start. Perhaps the pressures to live out a role that one was born to but did not choose for oneself and to which one's temperament was unsuited had been too much for the father. The Brahmin grew up and had a family of his own. He put his father's humiliation behind him. But in the anonymity of the big city, he began to see the hardships and inequities all around him. The dust rising from the streets and into the thick air, the street sweepers and the scavengers who he had been told accepted their lot beneath him. But he knew from the Dalit who had stood up to his father that they did not accept their lot, that they were not the docile, lazy creatures of caste mythology. The Brahmin came to know and to admire the few Dalits who crossed his path in his work, who had pushed through the walls of caste to become educated, professional. He came to realize that they were as capable as he was, and in fact, that because they had to come so far, they knew things about the world that his privilege had not required him to know. He saw that the caste system created a smooth path for some and broken glass shoals for others, that creativity and intellect were not restricted to one group alone. These were the people whose very sight and touch was said to be polluting, and yet here he was sitting across from them, sharing and learning from them. He was the beneficiary of their gifts rather than the other way around, and he came to see what had been lost by one not getting to know the other for his lifetime and all the lifetimes before his. He began to see himself differently, to see the illusion of his presumed superiority, that he had been told a lie, and that his father had been told a lie, and that trying to live up to the lie had taken some part of his father away. For this, he bore a heavy guilt and shame over the tragedy that had befallen the family, and a memory that would not leave him. He wanted to be free of it. He shared this realization with a Dalit he had come to know and told him of a decision he had made. "I have ripped off my sacred thread," he told the Dalit, a professional man. "It was a poisonous snake around my neck, and its toxic venom was getting inside of me." For most of his life, he had worn the sacred thread as if it were strands of hair from his head. Removing it amounted to renouncing his high caste, and he considered the consequences that his family might reject him if they knew. He would have to determine how to manage their knowing when the time came. He was now born a third time, the shades lifted in a darkened room in his mind. "It is a fake crown that we wear," he came to realize. He wished every dominant caste person could awaken to this fact. "My message would be to take off the fake crown. It will cost you more to keep it than to let it go. It is not real. It is just a marker of your programming. You will be happier and freer without it. You will see all of humanity. You will find your true self." And so he had discovered. "There was a stench coming from my body," he said. "I have located the corpse inside my mind. I have given it a decent burial. And now my journey can begin." The radicalization of the dominant caste. We had sat down for dinner, a family friend and I, at a chic restaurant in a hip section of a major American city. I did not know her well, but I knew that she was an artsy, free spirit, kind-hearted, well-traveled. She was also from the dominant caste and had grown up in a neighborhood surrounded mainly by people like herself. As we sat catching up on each other's lives, lives that each of us had known only from afar, several waiters passed by, and it was unclear which one was ours. Finally, a waiter stopped at our table. He was blonde, curt, and matter-of-fact. I ordered fish, she ordered pasta. We both ordered drinks, an appetizer or two. While we waited for the drinks to arrive, a couple from the dominant caste, same caste as her, sat down at the table next to us. Our waiter rushed over to take their order, now charming and effusive, filling them in on the specials, chatting them up. Seconds later, he brought a basket of bread to their table. He brought them their drinks shortly thereafter, while we sipped water and waited for hours. The family friend was growing impatient, seething, actually, and turned to see where he was. She was trying to process an unaccustomed disregard. The waiter rolled around to check on the people next to us yet again and to deliver drinks and bread to other tables down the row. Trying to keep calm, she motioned for him to come over. "We haven't gotten our drinks yet," she said. "Can you bring us our drinks, please? And we'd like bread too," she added, looking over at the couple who had arrived after us. They were now dipping theirs in olive oil, as we stared at an empty table. He nodded and said sure, but stopped to check on several other tables on his way back to the kitchen, which delayed him further. He reappeared later with dishes on his tray, but these were now the appetizers for the couple at the next table. The family friend motioned to him again. "Our drinks? And we never got the bread." "Oh, right, sure," he said, turning back again. It was now hard for her to concentrate on whatever it was she was saying. The people next to us were remarking on how good the appetizers were and had all but finished their bread. Their table was laden and ours was empty, and she seemed exquisitely aware of the couple beside us, that they were passing us on the escalator of dining attention. On one of his many rounds past our table, the waiter at last brought the drinks but not the bread, and the exclusion was now impossible to ignore. Finally, He showed up with the entrees. The people next to us were on to their desserts, which were lovely, apparently, from what they were saying. She stared at the pasta and jostled it with her fork, tasted it, and set the fork down. "Pasta's cold. It's not even good. How's your fish?" "It's okay, not great. Mine's cold, too." "I'm getting the waiter." Her face was now approaching crimson. She fidgeted in her seat and looked around for him, shaking her head in disbelief. She was barely able to keep it together. "Can you come here a second?" she called out to him as he passed again. "I know exactly what this is about. This is about racism." Her voice was rising. She was loud enough for the whole restaurant to hear. "You're a racist. This restaurant is racist. We sat here all this time, and you served all these other people at all these other tables, and you ignored us this whole time just because she's African-American." People at other tables were now looking over at me when I had not wanted the attention. I had no interest in making a federal case out of this. If I responded like that every time I was slighted, I'd be telling someone off almost every day. But she was just getting started. "I want your name. I want the manager's name. I will turn this place out." She pushed the bowl of pasta to the center of the table. "The pasta's cold," she said. "I can't even eat it. Her fish is cold. She can't eat hers. I'm not paying. We're not paying. I'm telling everybody I know not to come here. This is crap." With all of the ruckus, the manager came out to see what was going on. As it happened, the manager was a petite African-American woman who seemed cowed by the ferocity of this newly minted anti-racist, anti-castist, upper caste woman standing before her enraged at the unaccustomed humiliation. The manager apologized profusely, but my friend was having none of it. She stormed out of the restaurant, and I walked out with her. It took a while for her to calm down. Part of me wanted to say to her, "Imagine going through something like this almost every day, not knowing when or how it might happen. You wouldn't last very long. We can't afford to be blowing up every time we're slighted and ignored. We stand up when we need to, but we have to find a way not to go off every time and still get through the day." Part of me resented that she could go ballistic and get away with it when I might not even be believed. It was caste privilege to go off in the restaurant the way she did. It was a measure of how differently we are treated that she could live for over 40 years and not experience what is a daily possibility for any person born to the subordinate caste, that it was so alien to her, it so jangled her, that she blew up over it. But part of me wished that every person in the dominant caste who denies and deflects, minimizes and gaslights African Americans and other marginalized people could experience what she did. She had been radicalized in a matter of minutes. She knew full well that this was not how people treated her when she was out with others in the dominant caste. She had come to the realization on her own. And part of me, the biggest part of me, was happy to see her righteous indignation on my behalf, on her own behalf, and on behalf of all the people who endure these indignities every day. It would be a better world if everyone could feel what she felt for once and awaken. Chapter 31. The Heart is the Last Frontier. December 2016, 1 month after the election. He smelled of beer and tobacco. He was wearing a cap like the men at the rallies who wanted to make America great again, the people who had prevailed in the election the month before. His belly extended over his belt buckle. The years had carved lines into his face, and stubble was poking through his chin and cheeks. He let out a phlegmy cough. I had called the plumbing company because I had discovered water in the basement, and he was the one they sent. He was standing at the threshold of my front door and seemed not to have expected someone who looked like me to answer. It's a predominantly white neighborhood, with joggers and cyclists and purposeful moms in yoga sweats pushing baby strollers, ponytails bouncing, maybe a labradoodle trotting behind. Landscapers' trucks and housekeeping crews squeeze past each other on every side street. I was used to that reaction. Is the lady of the house at home? A leafleteer or survey taker will ask me, the only lady in sight standing right there in front of them. The assumption doesn't inspire me to indulge them. I could correct them if I wanted, and they might try to play it off, or I could just spare them the embarrassment. No, she's not here, I'll say. They never press me, never seem to suspect. Do you know when she'll be back? No, I don't, I'll say. Who shall I say is calling? They will hand me a card or a flyer, and I will give it a glance as they go on their way. So the plumber checked to see if this was, in fact, the right house, then walked in with a let's get this over with look on his face. Where's the basement? I was reliant on this man and others like him, now that I was both widowed and motherless, having lost the two most important people in my life within a span of 18 months. I was having to depend on contractors to fix things in this house, people who might resent me for being here and might or might not be inclined to help me or even to do their job. And now the air had shifted after the election. He followed me into the basement and stood there as I moved boxes to make space for him to better inspect it. I moved my mother's portable wheelchair, the one she would not be needing anymore, and a lampshade, stacks of my late father's engineering books, and an old bucket as the plumber watched, never reaching over to help. I began sweeping water toward the sump pump as he looked down at the wet floor. I told him that there had been 3 or 4 inches of water, that the HVAC man had helped get the sump pump restarted to drain most of the water out, that this had never happened before. I hardly ever come into the basement, I told him. We had that drought, so I didn't think about water in the basement. My husband was the one who came down here. He was the one who checked the filter on the furnace, checked the fuse box, patched things in his workshop, which was exactly as he had left it, the sawhorse and drill bits untouched from whenever he'd last come down to fix something before he died. He died last year, I told the plumber. The magnitude of that statement seemed not to register. The plumber just shrugged and said, uh-huh. I was sweeping the water with him standing there, and I was remembering what had happened in the last week. I'd been trying to get as far away from the grief as I could over the holidays. I would have left the planet if that had been an option, but that was not yet possible. So I had planned the next best, most convenient recourse to detach from the gravity of loss, which was a ticket to Buenos Aires. I had never been to Buenos Aires, so there were no memories to surface there, nothing to make me think of having seen or done this or that with anyone I had lost. As I was preparing to go, the HVAC contractor arrived for the semi-annual check of the furnace and discovered water in the basement. He was an immigrant from Central America, and though it was not his job, he helped to drain it as best he could. The plumber was now surveying the boxes and stepped around a few of them, knocking a lampshade and wreath to the wet floor, and not reaching over to pick them up. I kept sweeping. It appeared as if there was nothing further for him to do, or at least I would say he wasn't doing anything. He pointed to the sink. That's where the water's coming in, he said, looking to wrap this up. But the sink's never overflowed before, I said. It had to be more than that. How long's it been since the water came? Maybe since the rains last week. There's a drain here somewhere. I wonder if it's clogged. I started moving boxes and was feeling more alone with him just standing there. I lifted a heavy box, and he watched, made no gesture to help. He merely said, "You got that?" I had moved enough boxes to see where I thought the drain would be and still didn't locate it. It seemed this should be part of the troubleshooting, but he showed no interest. "Maybe it's the sump pump," I asked. He went to look at it. "Nothing wrong with the sump pump," he said. I now noticed packing popcorn floating in it. Could that have kept the sump pump from working? "No," he said. "But the sump pump needs clearing out, though." Why was he not doing that? Wasn't that what he was here for? Instead, he offered to write an estimate for a new one. But why buy a new pump if this one was working? I had called him in to fix whatever caused the water to build up. Since he'd arrived, I was the one sweeping water, moving boxes, searching for the drain. He was doing less than the HVAC guy had done. I was steaming now. All he was doing was standing there, watching me sweep, as women who look like me have done for centuries, and not fixing anything. He had come up with no answers, shown no interest, and now it appeared I was going to have to pay him for doing nothing. Since he wasn't helping, I felt I had nothing to lose. Something came over me, and I threw a Hail Mary at his humanity. "My mother just died last week," I told him. "Is your mother still alive?" He looked down at the wet floor. "No, no, she isn't." Somehow I had sensed that already, which is why I brought it up. "She died in 1991, he said. "She was 52 years old. "That's not old at all," I said. "No, she wasn't. My father's still alive. He's 78. He's in a home south of here. My sister lives nearby to him." "You're lucky to still have your father," I said. "Well, he's mean as they come." I contemplated the significance of that. What might his father have exposed him to when it comes to people who look like me? But I kept it to the present. "You miss them when they're gone, no matter what they were like," I said. "How about your mother?" he wanted to know. "How old was she?" "She was way older than yours, so I can't complain about that. But she was sick a long time, and you never get over it. I have an aunt in her 80s who still smokes and will ask you for a taste of beer," he said, and let slip a laugh. "She's on my daddy's side." I smiled and tried to look at the positive. "So your father's side is long-lived," I said. "Yeah, I guess they are." His face brightened, and he went over to the sump pump, bent down, and reached into it. A minute or two later, he stood up. "Okay, sump pump's cleared out." He turned to the area where the drain was likely to be. "It's probably under this coffee table," he said. "If you get one end, we can move it and see where it is." Together, we moved the table, and sure enough, there was the drain. "Drain's not clogged, so that's not the problem," he said. "Let me go get my flashlight out of the truck." Once back, he trained the flashlight along the floor, inspecting the perimeter of the basement, past the sink and the washer and dryer hemmed in with boxes, past the sawhorse, along the base of the furnace, every corner, up and down. "I found it," he said, jubilant. I ran over to him. "What was it?" "It's the water heater. Water heater's gone bad." He shone the flashlight onto the top of the heater, onto the corroded pipes and the steam rising from the gaps. Water had been escaping from the broken heater and had risen into a low flood on the basement floor, which explained why the flood water was clear and why my water bill was high. I stepped back in relief. I knew it had to be more than the rain. "You'll need a new water heater. This one's gone." How different things had been just minutes before. "My mother must have been talking to your mother," I said, "and telling her to get her boy to help her girl down there. My daughter needs your son's help." We smiled at the thought of that. He shut off the water to the heater, which meant no more hot water in the house for now, but more important, no more water escaping to the basement floor. He gave me the estimate for the replacement heater and charged me $69 for the visit, which I thought was fair. We wished each other a happy holiday, and he left. The phone rang. It happened to be Bunny Fisher, whose father, Dr. Robert Pershing Foster, I had written about in The Warmth of Other Suns. She was calling to check on me, having kept in close touch over the years, and even more so with my recent losses. I told her about the encounter with the plumber and the minor miracle that had happened as we began to catch up. Just then the doorbell rang, the call cut short. It was the plumber again. He said he had driven back to shut off the gas to the water heater so it wouldn't be heating an empty tank. He knew his way around now, made his way to the basement, was lighthearted and chatty, momentarily family. "This thing could have been much worse," he said. "Water could have burst from the top, destroyed everything, and scalded you or anybody else who tried to fix it. I've seen way worse." As he headed back up the basement steps, he caught a glimpse of some old Polaroid photographs that I'd salvaged from the wet boxes and had pulled aside to air out. He paused in the middle of the staircase. "Oh, you want those," he said. "That's memories right there." Then he bounded out of the old house and into the light of the day. Epilogue. A world without caste. We look to the night sky and see the planets and stars, the distant lights as specks of salt, single grains of sand, and are reminded of how small we are, how insignificant our worries of the moment, how brief our time on this planet. And we wish to be part of something bigger than ourselves, to magnify our significance, to matter somehow, as more than the dust that we are. Even the longest lived of our species spends but a blink of time in the span of human history. How dare anyone cause harm to another soul, curtail their life or life's potential when our lives are so short to begin with? The species has suffered incomprehensible loss over the false divisions of caste. The 11 million people killed by the Nazis, the 750,000 Americans killed in the Civil War over the right to enslave human beings, the slow living death and unfulfilled gifts of millions more on the plantations in India and in the American South. Whatever creativity or brilliance they had has been lost for all time. Where would we be as a species had the millions of targets of these caste systems been permitted to live out their dreams or live at all? Where would the planet be had the putative beneficiaries been freed of the illusions that imprisoned them too? Had they directed their energies towards solutions for all of humanity, cures for cancer and hunger and the existential threat of climate change rather than division? In December 1932, one of the smartest men who ever lived landed in America on a steamship with his wife and their 30 pieces of luggage as the Nazis bore down on their homeland of Germany. Albert Einstein, the physicist and Nobel laureate, had managed to escape the Nazis just in time. The month after Einstein left, Hitler was appointed chancellor. In America, Einstein was astonished to discover that he had landed in yet another caste system, one with a different scapegoat caste and different methods, but with embedded hatreds that were not so unlike the one he had just fled. "The worst disease is the treatment of the Negro," he wrote in 1946. "Everyone who freshly learns of this state of affairs at a maturer age feels not only the injustice, but the scorn of the principle of the fathers who founded the United States, that all men are created equal." He could hardly believe that a reasonable man can cling so tenaciously to such prejudice, he said. He and his wife, Elsa, settled in Princeton, New Jersey, where he took a professorship at the university and observed firsthand the oppression faced by Black residents who were consigned to the worst parts of town, to segregated movie houses, to servant positions, and were, in the words of his friend Paul Robeson, forced into bowing and scraping to the drunken rich. A few years into his tenure, the opera singer Marian Anderson, a renowned contralto born to the subordinated caste, performed to an overflow crowd at MacArthur Theater in Princeton and to rapturous praise in the press of her complete mastery of a magnificent voice. But the Nassau Inn in Princeton refused to rent a room to her for the night. Einstein, learning of this, invited her to stay in his home. From then on, she would stay at the Einstein residence whenever she was in town, even after Princeton hotels began accepting African-American guests. They would remain friends until his death. Being a Jew myself, perhaps I can understand and empathize with how Black people feel as victims of discrimination, he told a family friend. He grew uncomfortable with the American way of pressuring newcomers to look down on the lowest caste in order to gain acceptance. He was one of the most brilliant men who ever lived, refusing to see himself as superior to people he was being told were beneath him. "The more I feel an American, the more this situation pains me," Einstein wrote. "I can escape the feelings of complicity in it only by speaking out." And so he did. He co-chaired a committee to end lynching. He joined the NAACP. He spoke out on behalf of civil rights activists, lent his fame to their cause. At a certain point in his life, he rarely accepted the many honors that came his way. But in 1946, he made an exception for Lincoln University, a historically Black college in Pennsylvania. He agreed to deliver the commencement address and to accept an honorary degree there. On that visit, he taught his theory of relativity to physics students and played with the children of Black faculty, among them the son of the university president, a young Julian Bond, who would go on to become a civil rights leader. "The separation of the races is not a disease of the colored people," Einstein told the graduates at commencement, "but a disease of the white people. I do not intend to be quiet about it." He became a passionate ally of the people consigned to the bottom. "He hates race prejudice," W.E.B. Du Bois wrote, "because as a Jew, he knows what it is." The tyranny of caste is that we are judged on the very things we cannot change. A chemical in the epidermis, the shape of one's facial features, the signposts on our bodies of gender and ancestry, superficial differences that have nothing to do with who we are inside. The caste system in America is 400 years old and will not be dismantled by a single law or any one person, no matter how powerful. We have seen in the years since the civil rights era that laws like the Voting Rights Act of 1965 can be weakened if there is not the collective will to maintain them. A caste system persists in part because we, each and every one of us, allow it to exist in large and small ways in our everyday actions, in how we elevate or demean, embrace or exclude on the basis of the meaning attached to people's physical traits. If enough people buy into the lie of natural hierarchy, then it becomes the truth or is assumed to be. Once awakened, we then have a choice. We can be born to the dominant caste, but choose not to dominate. We can be born to a subordinated caste, but resist the box others force upon us. And all of us can sharpen our powers of discernment to see past the external and to value the character of a person rather than demean those who are already marginalized or worship those born to false pedestals. We need not bristle when those deemed subordinate break free, but rejoice that here may be one more human being who can add their true strengths to humanity. The goal of this work has not been to resolve all of the problems of a millennia-old phenomenon, but to cast a light onto its history, its consequences, and its presence in our everyday lives, and to express hopes for its resolution. A housing inspector does not make the repairs on the building he has examined. It is for the owners, meaning each of us, to correct the ruptures we have inherited. The fact is that the bottom caste, though it bears much of the burden of the hierarchy, did not create the caste system, and the bottom caste alone cannot fix it. The challenge has long been that many in the dominant caste who are in a better position to fix caste inequity have often been least likely to want to. Caste is a disease, and none of us is immune. It is as if alcoholism is encoded in the country's DNA and can never be declared fully cured. It is like a cancer that goes into remission only to return when the immune system of the body politic is weakened. Thus, regardless of who prevails in any given election, the country still labors under the divisions that a caste system creates, and the fears and resentments of a dominant caste that is too often in opposition to the yearnings of those deemed beneath them. It is a danger to the species and to the planet to have this depth of unexamined grievance and discontent in the most powerful nation in the world. A single election will not solve the problems that we face if we haven't dealt with the structure that created the imbalance to begin with. As it stands, the United States is facing a crisis of identity unlike any before. The country is headed toward an inversion of its demographics, with its powerful white majority expected to be outnumbered by people not of European descent within two decades. This is unknown territory for everyone in the hierarchy, an ethnic distribution that could potentially look closer to that of South Africa than to what Americans have grown accustomed to. Anticipatory fear seems already to have surfaced, but if history is any guide, a change in demographics might have less of a material effect on the dominant caste than imagined. A 2016 study found that if disparities in wealth were to continue at the current pace, it would take Black families 228 years to amass the wealth that white families now have, and Latino families another 84 years to reach parity. Thus, as in South Africa, there would be no reason to believe that economic, social, and in America, political dominance would not still remain in the hands of those who have held it for the entirety of the country's history. This will be a test of the cherished ideal of majority rule, the moral framework for caste dominance in America since its founding. White dominance has already been assured by the inherited advantages of the dominant caste in most every sphere of life, and in the securing of dominant caste interests in most aspects of governing, from gerrymandered congressional districts to voter suppression to the rightward direction of the judicial branch to the Electoral College, which favors the dominant caste, whatever the numbers. Will the United States adhere to its belief in majority rule if the majority does not look as it has throughout history? This will be the chance for America either to further entrench its inequalities or to choose to lead the world as the exceptional nation that we have proclaimed ourselves to be. Without an enlightened recognition of the price we all pay for a caste system, the hierarchy will likely shapeshift as it has in the past to ensure that the structure remains intact. The definition of whiteness could well expand to confer honorary whiteness to those on the border, the lightest-skinned people of Asian or Latino descent, or biracial people with a white parent, for instance, to increase the ranks of the dominant caste. The devastating truth is that without the intervention of humanitarian impulses, a reconstituted caste system could divide those at the bottom and those in the middle, pick off those closest to white, and thus isolate the darkest Americans even further, lock them ever more tightly to the bottom rung. It would be a crisis of spirit, a defeat of the American soul, because the toxins upstream eventually make their way downstream, as has occurred with the addiction crisis in America. It turns out that everyone benefits when society meets the needs of the disadvantaged. The sacrifices of the subordinate caste during the civil rights era, for instance, benefited women of all ethnicities, the wives, daughters, sisters, and nieces of every American man. Women who now have legal protections against job discrimination that they did not have before the 1960s. Many of the advancements that Americans enjoy and that are under assault in our current day, birthright citizenship, equal protection under the law, the right to vote, laws against discrimination on the basis of gender, race, national origin, are all the byproducts of the subordinate caste's fight for justice in this country and ended up helping others as much as, if not more, than themselves. To imagine an end to caste in America, we need only look at the history of Germany. It is living proof that if a caste system, the 12-year reign of the Nazis, can be created, it can be dismantled. We make a serious error when we fail to see the overlap between our country and others, the common vulnerability in human programming, what the political theorist Hannah Arendt called the banality of evil. It's all too easy to imagine that the Third Reich was a bizarre aberration, wrote the philosopher David Livingstone Smith, who has studied cultures of dehumanization. It's tempting to imagine that the Germans were or are a uniquely cruel and bloodthirsty people. But these diagnoses are dangerously wrong. What's most disturbing about the Nazi phenomenon is not that the Nazis were madmen or monsters. It's that they were ordinary human beings. It is also tempting to vilify a single despot at the sight of injustice, when in fact, it is the actions, or more commonly, inactions of ordinary people that keep the mechanism of caste running. The people who shrug their shoulders at the latest police killing, the people who laugh off the coded put-downs of marginalized people shared at the dinner table and say nothing for fear of alienating an otherwise beloved uncle. The people who are willing to pay higher property taxes for their own children's schools, but who balk at taxes to educate the children society devalues. Or the people who sit in silence as a marginalized person, whether of color or a woman, is interrupted in a meeting, her ideas dismissed, though perhaps later adopted, for fear of losing caste. Each of these keeping intact the whole system that holds everyone in its grip. Caste is not a physical object like a wall of bricks or a line of barbed wire, the Dalit leader Bhimrao Ambedkar wrote. Caste is a notion. It is a state of mind. No one escapes its tentacles. No one escapes exposure to its message that one set of people is presumed to be inherently smarter, more capable, and more deserving than other groups deemed lower. This program has been installed into the subconscious of every one of us, and high or low, without intervention or reprogramming, we act out the script we were handed. And yet somehow, there are the rare people like Einstein who seem immune to the toxins of caste in the air we breathe, who manage to transcend what most people are susceptible to. From the abolitionists who risked personal ruin to end slavery, to the white civil rights workers who gave their lives to help end Jim Crow, and the political leaders who outlawed it, these all too rare people are a testament to the human spirit, that humans can break free of the hierarchy's hold on them. These are people of personal courage and conviction, secure within themselves, willing to break convention, not reliant on the approval of others for their sense of self, people of deep and abiding empathy and compassion. They are what many of us might wish to be, but not nearly enough of us are. Perhaps, once awakened, more of us will be. Americans pay a steep price for a caste system that runs counter to the country's stated ideals. Before 1965, the year of the Voting Rights Act, the United States was neither a democracy nor a meritocracy because the majority of its population was excluded from competition in most aspects of American life. People who happened to be born male and of European ancestry competed only against themselves. For most of American history, the country was closed off from the talents of the bulk of its people of all colors, genders, and nationalities. Anyone who truly believes in a meritocracy would not want to be in a caste system in which certain groups of people are excluded or disqualified by long-standing deprivations. A win is not legitimate if whole sections of humanity are not in the game. Those are victories with an asterisk, as if you were to win the gold medal in hockey the year that the Finns and Canadians were not competing. The full embrace of all humanity lifts the standards of any human endeavor. Our era calls for a public accounting of what caste has cost us, a Truth and Reconciliation Commission, so that every American can know the full history of our country, wrenching though it may be. The persistence of caste and race hostility and the defensiveness about anti-black sentiment in particular make it literally unspeakable to many in the dominant caste. You cannot solve anything that you do not admit exists, which could be why some people may not want to talk about it. It might get solved. We must make every effort to ensure that the past injustice, violence, and economic discrimination will be made known to the people, Einstein said in an address to the National Urban League. The taboo, the let's not talk about it, must be broken. It must be pointed out time and again that the exclusion of a large part of the colored population from active civil rights by the common practices is a slap in the face of the Constitution of the nation. The challenge for our era is not merely the social construct of black and white, but seeing through the many layers of a caste system that has more power than we as humans should permit it to have. Even the most privileged of humans in the Western world will join a tragically disfavored caste if they live long enough. They will belong to the last caste of the human cycle, that of old age, people who are among the most demeaned of all citizens in the Western world, where youth is worshipped to forestall thoughts of death. A caste system spares no one. When an accident of birth aligns with what is most valued in a given caste system, whether being able-bodied, male, white, or other traits in which we had no say, it gives that lottery winner a moral duty to develop empathy for those who must endure the indignities they themselves have been spared. It calls for a radical kind of empathy. Empathy is not sympathy. Sympathy is looking across at someone and feeling sorrow, often in times of loss. Empathy is not pity. Pity is looking down from above and feeling a distant sadness for another in their misfortune. Empathy is commonly viewed as putting yourself in someone else's shoes and imagining how you would feel. That could be seen as a start, but that is little more than role-playing, and it is not enough in the ruptured world we live in. Radical empathy, on the other hand, means putting in the work to educate oneself and to listen with a humble heart to understand another's experience from their perspective, not as we imagine we would feel. Radical empathy is not about you. and what you think you would do in a situation you have never been in and perhaps never will. It is the kindred connection from a place of deep knowing that opens your spirit to the pain of another as they perceive it. Empathy is no substitute for experience itself. We don't get to tell a person with a broken leg or a bullet wound that they are or are not in pain. And people who have hit the caste lottery are not in a position to tell a person who has suffered under the tyranny of caste what is offensive or hurtful or demeaning to those at the bottom. The price of privilege is the moral duty to act when one sees another person treated unfairly. And the least that a person in the dominant caste can do is not make the pain any worse. If each of us could truly see and connect with the humanity of the person in front of us, search for that key that opens the door to whatever we may have in common, whether cosplay or Star Trek or the loss of a parent, it could begin to affect how we see the world and others in it. Perhaps change the way we hire or even vote. Each time a person reaches across caste and makes a connection, it helps to break the back of caste. Multiplied by millions in a given day, it becomes the flap of a butterfly wing that shifts the air and builds to a hurricane across an ocean. With our current ruptures, it is not enough to not be racist or sexist. Our times call for being pro-African American, pro-woman, pro-Latino, pro-Asian, pro-Indigenous, pro-humanity, in all its manifestations. In our era, it is not enough to be tolerant. You tolerate mosquitoes in the summer, a rattle in an engine, the gray slush that collects at the crosswalk in winter. You tolerate what you would rather not have to deal with and wish would go away. It is no honor to be tolerated. Every spiritual tradition says, love your neighbor as yourself. Not tolerate them. As each of us came into consciousness, we learned, based on the random outward manifestation of the combinations of genes that collided at the precise moment of our conception, that because of what we look like, the world had already assigned a place for us. It was up to each of us to accept or challenge the role we were cast into, to determine for ourselves and to make the world see that what is inside of us, our beliefs and dreams, how we love and express that love, the things that we can actually control, is more important than the outward traits we had no say in. That we are not what we look like, but what we do with what we have, what we make of what we are given, how we treat others and our planet. Human beings across time and continents are more alike than they are different. The central question about human behavior is not why do those people do this or act in that way, now or in ages past, but what is it that human beings do when faced with a given circumstance? None of us chose the circumstances of our birth. We had nothing to do with having been born into privilege or under stigma. We have everything to do with what we do with our God-given talents and how we treat others in our species from this day forward. We are not personally responsible for what people who look like us did centuries ago, but we are responsible for what good or ill we do to people alive with us today. We are, each of us, responsible for every decision we make that hurts or harms another human being. We are responsible for recognizing that what happened in previous generations at the hands of or to people who look like us set the stage for the world we now live in, and that what has gone before us grants us advantages or burdens through no effort or fault of our own, gains or deficits that others who do not look like us often do not share. We are responsible for our own ignorance, or with time and open-hearted enlightenment, our own wisdom. We are responsible for ourselves and our own deeds or misdeeds in our time, and in our own space, and will be judged accordingly by succeeding generations. In a world without caste, instead of a false swagger over our own tribe or family or ascribed community, we would look upon all of humanity with wonderment. The lithe beauty of an Ethiopian runner, the bravery of a Swedish girl determined to save the planet, the physics-defying aerobatics of an African-American Olympian, the brilliance of a composer of Puerto Rican descent who can rap the history of the founding of America at 144 words a minute. All of these feats should fill us with astonishment at what the species is capable of, and gratitude to be alive for this. In a world without caste, being male or female, light or dark, immigrant or native born, would have no bearing on what anyone was perceived as being capable of. In a world without caste, we would all be invested in the well-being of others in our species, if only for our own survival, and recognize that we are in need of one another more than we have been led to believe. We would join forces with indigenous people around the world, raising the alarm as fires rage and glaciers melt. We would see that when others suffer, the collective human body is set back from the progression of our species. A world without caste would set everyone free. This is Robin Miles. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Caste, The Origins of Our Discontents by Isabel Wilkerson. This program was directed by David Rapkin. Executive producer, Orly Moskowitz. Edited by BookTrack. Text copyright 2020 by Isabel Wilkerson. Production copyright 2020, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.